Those are big pharmaceutical companies and big private insurance who too often provide the money for the politicians who remain stuck in the middle ground rather than pushing all the way. But I'm with you. I'm with you, though, brother. Indeed, indeed.
We are going to end the discussion here, but we continue the conversation always as we continue Breaking with Convention next week, covering the Republican National Convention. That does it for our broadcast. Dr. Cornel West, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Practice of Public Policy at Harvard University, and Ben Jealous, now President of People for the American Way. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Libby, Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands of Oregonians line up to receive a one-time payment of $500. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says there are two ways to reduce the virus enough for schools to reopen. And the Black Resilience Fund provides resources for the Black community in Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 21st, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. On Wednesday and Thursday, thousands of Oregonians lined up for a one-time payment of $500. Many more are expected to join them today and for as long as the money holds out. The payment was authorized by the state legislature to provide help to those who had not been able to get their full unemployment benefits because of Oregon Employment Department problems. To qualify, applicants must be Oregon residents earning less than $48,000 per year prior to the started the pandemic and who are experiencing financial hardship as a result. To fund the program, the state allocated $35 million from Oregon's federal relief package and plans to distribute payments on a first-come, first-served basis. Credit unions around the state agreed to process the payment without charge to the state or recipients, and estimates are that there should be enough to pay about 70,000 people. To ensure compliance with eligibility guidelines, the program requires that recipients apply in person, and some institutions require that individuals make an appointment to apply. And by yesterday, many were booked through the end of the month, although it's likely the fund will run out long before that time. OnPoint Credit Union chose not to require appointments and quickly saw long lines form on Wednesday morning. The credit union has 31 locations in Oregon and is expected to handle about 40% of the payments. OnPoint employees walked the lines, reminding people of ID requirements and handing out applications. Yesterday, it was reported that a Good Samaritan pulled up to the Hillsboro OnPoint location and proceeded to hand out $100 bills to everyone in line. Witnesses estimate that the man handed out thousands of dollars. He never identified himself or asked for thanks before getting back in his car and driving away. A startup nonprofit that's less than 3 months old has already raised over $1.5 million for the Black community in Portland. The Black Resilience Fund came into existence during the protests and civil unrest that has gripped Portland and the nation since the death of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. Fund organizer Cameron Witten says that Portland has had a Black community for generations, but the displacement of those North and Northeast neighborhoods has made it difficult for Black Portlanders to connect and help each other. According to Witten, applicants for funding go through a thorough screening process where they explain exactly how the money will be used to help the community. To date, over $700,000 has been distributed, and 10,000 applicants are waiting for an opportunity to explain how they would put the money to use. Witten says he knew they were going to be successful raising money and that the organization posts updates to their GoFundMe site on a daily basis showing exactly where the donations are going. In an interview, he said, quote, "We have built in transparency and accountability methods so that we can address any questions people have about how we leverage these dollars to support our neighbors." This week, the Black Resilience Fund established a new program called #WeDoHeal with the goal of providing $300 to every Black Portlander in need. He said the organization already delivers 300 food boxes per week and that the $300 can be used for food, utility bills, medical expenses, and so on. Witten said that, quote, "There's a lot of need in our community, and we're trying to help raise the resources that we know that are in Portland so that our neighbors can live easier." A grant from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has been given to the Oregon Food Bank to prevent millions of pounds of donated food from going to waste. The Oregon Food Bank normally receives bulk donations of fresh produce from local growers. Food Bank volunteers then clean, separate, and repackage the food into more manageable family-size portions. But since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, nonprofits such as the Oregon Food Bank are operating with a fraction of their normal volunteer workforce. Currently, only about a dozen workers are able to be in the warehouse at the same time due to health and safety regulations. That means that tons of fresh apples, onions, potatoes, and pears would go to waste or be dumped into landfills. Not only would that be tragic for those in need of the food, but the decomposing produce gives off carbon dioxide and methane, greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. As a result, earlier this week, the DEQ awarded $140,000 to the Oregon Food Bank. The money will allow the food bank to have the food repackaged at the source, ensuring that the food can still be distributed to those who need it most. DEQ Director Richard Whitman said, quote, "Redirecting food to feed hungry people is especially important right now. DEQ is not only supporting Oregon Food Bank with this grant, but also responding to Governor Kate Brown's call to reduce food waste and methane emissions from landfills. The grant will cover costs of transporting and repackaging more than 2 million pounds of fresh produce, resulting in nearly 1.7 million meals to people experiencing food insecurity. Previously, DEQ grants have provided more than $235,000 to assist the Oregon Food Bank's transportation and distribution efforts. At an 11 a.m. press briefing this morning, Oregon Governor Kate Brown recapped the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic before addressing what it would take for schools to reopen.
When I issued Oregon Stay Home, Save Lives order, some folks said it was too rash. Others said it was too late. And today, close to 6 months after our first case, some say my orders are too restrictive, that the virus isn't dangerous, or even that it's a hoax. Others say I haven't done enough, that we should shut down the entire economy immediately and start from scratch, regardless of the cost to people's livelihoods. Today, Oregon has one of the lowest COVID-19 mortality rates in the entire country. I want to say thank you to every Oregonian, every business, every local elected official who has helped put us in this position. Wearing masks, limiting social gatherings, enforcing health and safety rules, these strategies work. Unfortunately, it's still not enough. Our infection rate is still too high to get all of our kids safely back into the classrooms and most of our schools this fall. To keep students, teachers, and staff safe in our schools across the state, we need to see a much more rapid decline in case numbers, and we need to see it quickly. There are basically two ways to do this. One option, local community leaders, county officials and businesses, and all Oregonians can step up their efforts to implement and enforce our existing guidelines. The other option, we can implement further business restrictions and travel restrictions for people entering Oregon or returning from trips outside the state. I believe, and the data indicates, that either one of these strategies will work. Either one will drive down the spread of the virus more quickly. Either one gives us a fighting chance to open up in-person instruction and K through education in much of the state later this fall. Earlier this week, I challenged local elected officials and business leaders to step up their game. I asked our business leaders to take additional steps to ensure employee and customer safety, to reach 100% implementation of our health and safety protocols, making sure people are wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart. I'm here to deliver a message to local elected officials, local community leaders, and business leaders, and to every single Oregonian. Now is the time to step up even further. If we cannot improve our trajectory over the rest of the month by increased compliance with already existing policies and guidelines, unfortunately, I will need to add more restrictions. When it comes to controlling the virus, we have the tools. We need you, we need everyone to use them.
School districts around the state have prepared a mix of classroom options for the fall, but today's announcement all but ensures there will be no in-person classes for the traditional start of the school year. Brown stated that the infection rate needs to get down to about 60 cases per day before she will consider reopening in-classroom teaching. The current statewide rate is averaging about 300 cases per day. Half a dozen mail sorting machines have been dismantled at a Northeast Portland sorting facility, raising concerns over decisions made that seem designed to intentionally delay mail services. According to spokespeople from the American Postal Workers Union, 6 machines have been taken apart and put in storage on orders from the White House. President Trump has said the changes will make the United States Postal Service more efficient. In addition to the day-to-day sorting of mail, the machines in question would also sort ballots for the upcoming November election. The shutdown of the equipment has prompted criticism from postal workers and worries that mail services will be slowed during peak times. Last week, Trump said that he was blocking $25 billion in aid to the post office, as well as a proposal of $3.6 billion from Democrats meant to aid states to help process mail-in ballots. The The president made clear that he was not in favor of an increase in vote by mail and that he was unwilling to fund the post office if that was the intended result. On Tuesday, newly appointed U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said he would suspend many of his initiatives. His change of direction was driven in part by a storm of pending lawsuits from 20 states, maintaining the changes directed are deliberate actions aimed at slogging down the USPS and hampering mail-in voting. DeJoy, a longtime Republican fundraiser, started his job in mid-June and testified Friday morning before a Republican-led Senate committee to publicly answer questions regarding the Trump administration undermining USPS operations. Trump's recent attacks on the USPS are also affecting workers' morale. In April, he called the Postal Service a joke. Portland APW Union President Joe Kogan said, quote, "Getting the mail delivered is number one in our jobs. Anything that impedes that is a slap in our face and disrespectful to us and to the American people." Though Kogan has called the dismantling of sorting machines a mistake, he remains confident that mail-in ballots will be processed efficiently as long as voters submit them in a prompt fashion. Yesterday, the board of directors of NORCOR, the Northern Oregon Regional Corrections Facility, unanimously voted to stop housing detainees for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. The correctional facility, which is located in the Dalles, has held both adult and juveniles and has long been under public pressure to terminate its partnership with ICE. For years, demonstrators have gathered outside the facility to protest the ICE detentions. In announcing their decision, the NORCOR board cited a decline in the number of detainees being housed and a reduced dependence of income resulting from the ICE contract. Earlier this year, a bill to force NORCOR to stop contracting with ICE was introduced in the Oregon legislature. Both the Mark O. Hatfield United States Courthouse and the Federal Bankruptcy Court were closed today as the result of an unspecified threat of violence. The threat was identified by federal officers and also resulted in the closure of any businesses located within the building. Sources report that the threat was made Thursday evening, claiming that a vehicle filled with explosives would hit a federal building on Friday. Sources were unable to specify if that building is in Portland, what time the incident was supposed to occur, or motivations behind the threat. Authorities question whether the threat was related to any protest activity outside the Hatfield courthouse or any specific court case. The bankruptcy court said its services will continue to operate remotely, while hearings at the Hatfield courthouse that were set for Friday will have to be rescheduled. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, tune in for Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight, we can expect a cloudy evening with a chance of a passing shower and an overnight low of about 60. Tomorrow, we'll see a partly cloudy morning give way to afternoon sun with a high in the upper 70s. On this day in 1944, the Dumbarton Oaks Conference took place in Washington, D.C. The conference laid the groundwork for the United Nations. Today's quote is from former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson was the Democratic nominee for president in both 1952 and 1956. He was defeated in a landslide both times. Stevenson said, quote, "After 4 years at the United Nations, I sometimes yearn for the peace and tranquility of a political convention." A lawsuit by Catholic Social Services against the City of Philadelphia raises the risk that discrimination by agencies and even individuals could be legalized. For more on the story, here's Andrea Sears of the Public News Service.
Andrea Sears tells us creating a religious exemption to anti-discrimination laws could have far-reaching negative effects. That's the conclusion of a new report on a case soon to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court.
The City of Philadelphia refused to renew its contract with Catholic Social Services, a child welfare agency. It said the agency's policy of refusing to license same-sex couples as foster parents on religious grounds violates the city's non-discrimination law. CSS sued, saying denying a contract violates its rights to free exercise of religion and free speech. But Naomi Goldberg with the Movement Advancement Project says creating a religious exemption for CSS could open the door to similar claims for a wide variety of services.
The most broad way in which the court could rule could essentially create a constitutional right to discriminate for individuals, for businesses, and for taxpayer-funded entities.
Lower federal courts have ruled the city's policy is neutral and doesn't target CSS or its religious beliefs. The case is scheduled for Supreme Court arguments on November 4th.
That was Andrea Sears reporting for the Public News Service. Joe Biden accepts the nomination at the last night of the Democratic National Convention, while the Republicans get ready for Trump to do the same next week. With more on that story and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
This campaign isn't just about winning votes. It's about winning the heart and, yes, the soul of America.
Former Vice President Joe Biden accepted the Democratic presidential nomination on the last night of their convention. He explained who he's running for.
Winning it for the generous among us, not the selfish. Winning it for workers who keep this country going, not just the privileged few at the top. Winning it for those communities who have known the injustice of a knee on the neck. For all the young people have known only America being rising inequity and shrinking opportunity.
Host comedian Julia Louis-Dreyfus's jokes were interspersed with sober moments as well. Historian John Meacham echoed many other speakers.
This is a grave moment in America. A deadly virus is ravaging us. Our jobs are evaporating.
Viewers saw a deeply personal segment about Biden's stutter, his faith, his late first wife and daughter. To introduce him, his children evoked the memory of their brother Beau, an Iraqi veteran who died of cancer in 2015. Ed Good, a 95-year-old Republican and card-carrying NRA member, served in World War II and the Korean War. The veteran came out to endorse Biden after voting for Trump in 2016.
I think Trump has been the worst president we've ever had, so I'll be glad to see him go.
Seven of Biden's former presidential rivals also appeared on his behalf, many swapping heartfelt stories and jokes about the candidate. Former NYC Mayor Michael Bloomberg had a primetime spot, despite facing a lawsuit from former campaign staffers who alleged he reneged on a promise to provide wages and health care through November. Democrats paid tribute with another video honoring late Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms invoked Lewis in urging Americans to vote.
People often think that they can't make a difference, like our civil rights icons. But every person in the movement mattered.
Right before Biden's speech, Trump tore into Democrats on Fox News anchor Sean Hannity's show. He did the same at a rally in Pennsylvania earlier in the day. Ron Bishop, GOP chair in Wipon County, Wisconsin, hopes that next week's Republican National Convention, the president will focus more on pre-COVID successes than on arguments with Democrats.
What I'm hoping for is like a reset button where we can get on message and talk about the economy before COVID, talk about how Republican policies are the best way to get the economy back on as we come out of this pandemic, and talk about foreign policy successes and deregulation and stuff like that.
Yesterday, Trump lost another legal battle to prevent the release of his tax records to the Manhattan District Attorney. It was once again blocked by a federal judge. His former advisor, Steve Bannon, was also arrested and charged for allegedly defrauding donors who believed their money was going towards a private effort to build part of a border wall with Mexico. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Laguna Pueblo citizen Deb Holland addressed the Democratic National Convention last night. She is the U.S. representative from the 1st District of New Mexico and one of the first two Native American women to be elected to Congress. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. One of the first two Native American women elected to Congress addressed the Democratic National Convention Thursday night. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story.
President Donald Trump's administration has prized unwinding regulations, which has caused more dirty air and water in Indian country. New Mexico Democratic Congresswoman Deb Haaland is a citizen of the Pueblo of Laguna and one of just two Native American women ever elected to Congress. At the Democratic Party's virtual convention last evening, she told the audience that Native people's history, land, and lives matter.
I'm a symbol of our resilience as the embodiment of America's progress as a nation. I know we can't take our democracy for granted, especially now as people are dying, as our land is abused, as our Constitution is under attack. We must work for it.
To Haaland, that means Indian country needs to come out and vote this November.
Whether your ancestors have been here for hundreds of years or you're a new citizen, know this. Whether we vote and how we vote will determine if our nation's promise of social, racial, and environmental justice will outlast us.
Still, even in Haaland's home state of New Mexico, Republicans have also embarked on an intense effort to court Native American and Latino voters. That's because each party recognizes how pivotal November's elections will be. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Haaland's remarks were prior to Joe Biden's speech, where he officially accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president. He addressed COVID-19, economic recovery, racial justice, and many other issues facing the United States, vowing to work on them if elected president. Native DNC participants rallied around Biden this week. The Native American caucus met Thursday afternoon with a number of guests, including Jill Biden, Senator Bernie Sanders, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We see the stakes of this election every day, especially for the Native American communities that are feeling the pain of COVID more than others, from health care to voting rights to tribal sovereignty. Your rights are on the line.
We must elect an administration that will fight for the sovereignty, justice, opportunity, and dignity of Native people. The pain and the lies must end.
The issue of sovereignty, as we all know, is in our Constitution, and we want to make the fullest commitment to that. We do make the fullest commitment. We want everyone in our country to do so. And again, righting the wrong of the carcerary decision, something we've all been working on. We've had it in the House bill again and again, but not been able to make that improvement that we must make, and that's on the road ahead.
Following the political guests, the caucus hosted a panel on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The virtual convention wrapped up Thursday night. There was a heavy focus this week by Native participants and their political allies on getting out the Native vote in November. On Thursday, the Kansas City Chiefs announced new measures and policies following consultation on Native American culture. The NFL team will ban fans from wearing headdresses into the stadium and Indian-themed face paint. The team is engaged in a review process of the Arrowhead Chop. Change the name. Advocates have long called for the end of Native themes at games, but also would like the team to drop the use of its name. The new measures follow 6 years of work with a local group, according to the announcement. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's not just humans that need to be sheltered during a hurricane. Farm animals also need to be protected. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a hurricane approaches, everyone should act to protect themselves. But farmers and ranchers have to keep their animals safe, too.
Folks are learning more and more how to prepare for those disasters.
Sarah Bostick is an agriculture extension agent in Sarasota County, Florida. She says beef cattle, for example, tend to be resilient. So as long as they're in an area that won't flood, they are often safer outside than in a barn, which could collapse during a storm with high winds.
The best thing that you can do for your beef cattle is actually just to make sure they're in a pasture that is not near a major road and doesn't have any power lines running through it.
But horses require a different approach. Bostick says their pastures are often close to buildings and power lines, and they frighten easily.
Horses tend to be the animals that suffer the most when we have a storm that comes through. They have a major flight response.
So when possible, many owners choose to evacuate their horses, and others mark them with contact information in case they run away.
People use things like oil-based paint to paint their phone numbers directly onto the side of their horse.
So by understanding the unique needs of each species, owners can help protect them. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 21st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, no serious observers disagree